This is Fran reading from the Festival Weekend, Saturday edition of The Sun, July 25th. And so, of course, the front page is completely dominated by very vibrant color photos of festival-related activity. The first photo is the group from the Dominican Republic. They're marching in the Parade of Flags, which took place Friday the 24th. That's when all the ethnic groups marched from Boarding House Park, from City Hall down to Boarding House Park, with their flag representing their nation. And below them is a colorful photo of lovely little girls, Laotian girls, who also, all costumed, marched in the Parade of Flags on July 24th. The article is by Aaron Curtis, email address acurtis@lowellsun.com. That's A-C-U-R-T-I-S at lowellsun.com. It says more than an hour before the first flag rose above the Parade of Flags, downtown was already humming. Chairs, blankets, early bird spectators filled the lawn at Boarding House Park, staking out prime spots for the festival opening performances as the 39th Lowell Folk Festival went into motion Friday evening. Among those settling in were Marianne Ngoon, N-G-O-O-N, of Hudson, New Hampshire, and Diane Chanel, C-H-E-N-E-L-L-E, of Nashua, who arrived with the Ngoon children and a couple of plates of Laotian food, which Miss Chanel was happily working through. The pair said they had made a point to attend the festival every year. Mr. Ngoon said that we appreciate every moment we can be here because it's just fabulous, adding that the Filipino food is the one reason why she keeps coming back. She said, and the music. Where else can you hear all of this? I never knew that I liked Zydeco until I came here. This year's lineup includes Gino De La Fosse and French Walking Boogie, a Louisiana group known for its high-energy Zydeco performances. And Ms. Ngoon said the festival's atmosphere is also part of the draw, pointing out that people come here and get happy. Across the street from Boarding House Park, the food tents were already busy. The Greek food booths, operated by the Parent Teacher Association of the Hellenic American Academy on Broadway Street, was among them. Anastasia Kazanis, K-A-Z-A-N-I-S, working the tent, said that every dollar raised during the festival goes directly to the school. She said their tent has been at the festival for roughly 15 years, tucked between the Laotian and Filipino vendors, a placement that hasn't shifted at all this time, helping to create a nice backstage community. She said, we share things, we bring food over to one another, and make sure we're sampling each other's food. It's really great fun. For some, Friday marked their first taste of the festival. Jake Scoggin, S-C-O-G-I-G-I-N, and Sam Kumar, K-U-M-A-R, who just moved to Lowell from Worcester a week ago, said they stumbled onto the event after noticing advertisements and signs around the city. Scoggin said, we didn't know what it was. Now we're just poking around and seeing what's out here. The festival officially began with the Parade of Flags, which is a march from City Hall to Boarding House Park, and it featured representatives from 36 countries, each carrying their national flag. The Middlesex County Volunteers, which she will give everybody credit here now, led the procession, and a big, beautiful colored picture, I must say, of the of three more groups, which I've not mentioned, but I will. They led the group with fifes and drum. Before the parade stepped off, Lowell City Council Belinda Duran stood outside City Hall watching the diverse crowd and called it the most iconic event in Lowell. And she said, continuing, quoting her, and starting off with the Parade of Flags, it just showcases all the many cultures and heritage of Lowell. I think it's so wonderful that we all come together for this. As for her music pick of the week, Duran recommended Alash, which is a Tuvan throat singing ensemble. Day two of the festival will begin at noon on Saturday. That usually is the biggest day. And for more information, you can go online to lowellfolkfestival.org. Simpler than that, you cannot get lowellfolkfestival.org. And now on page two, we have three huge color photo. One, we see Jake Vitali, V-I-T-A-L-I, waving the Italian flags as the Italian group went through Boarding House Park on July 24th. Then underneath them, a big color picture of South Korean group as they go through the parade of flags. And below them, an even bigger group of Cambodians waving their flag as they go off through the parade of flags on July 24th, Friday night. Also, there is two other articles on the front page. One by Colin Young with his State House News Service, Boston Deadline. This about the Senate. We say that senators will add their own proposed framework for public access to legislative records to the mix next week, one that will follow similar contours of what the House supported last month, but without any of the language representatives passed to narrow the scope of the voter-approved legislative audit. The Senate Ways and Means Committee released its redraft, which is S-3200 of that House bill, or which is H-5469, on Thursday morning, and President Spilka said that the plan is for the senators to pass the bill Thursday, July 30th. As long as it's moved into conference by July 31st, the issue, including the House's audit-limiting language, can remain in play for formal sessions later this year, as voters also decide the fate of a related public records access ballot question November 3rd. The bill's passage through the Senate appears inevitable. It cleared Ways and Means with 15 members, all Democrats, voting in favor, no votes against, and 3 Republicans opting against voting yes or no. Ms. Spilka's office said the proposal is modeled on Pennsylvania's right-to-know law and outlines the process for members of the public to request legislative records, including a judicial appeals process for denied requests. It includes 19 categories of documents that would be considered legislative records, including legislative resolutions, summaries, fiscal notes, amendments, notices of committee hearings, records of hearing attendance, hearing transcripts and recordings, written testimonies solicited and received by a committee, legislative journals, recorded votes, and ethics disclosures. Much of that information is already informally considered to be public records and is made available to the public on the legislature's website in real time, but under the bill advancing in the Senate legislative offices, they would have to move up to 10 business days to provide it to a requester. The Senate Ways and Means Committee proposal includes 2 categories of legislative records that the House did not a list of the names, public offices, job titles, and salaries maintained by human resources and procurements and contracts for goods and services, unless they are otherwise exempt. The House definition included legislative caucuses and their members, but the Senate proposal does not. The Senate Ways and Means proposal also appears to have a more broad definition of legislative record. It would include records, quote, made, received, maintained, or kept, end quote, by the legislature, while the House version only spoke to documents, quote, made or received, end quote, by the House or Senate. Like the House bill, the Senate Ways and Means Committee proposal treats the governor's office one way and the legislature another. But unlike the House version, the bill the Senate will vote on would not simply apply the existing public records law to the governor's office. Instead, it would create 2 new parts of the public records law, new subsections specific to the governor's office, and an entire section for the legislature, with specific exemptions and carve-outs for each. For the governor's office, the Senate Ways and Means bill would require the designation of a records access officer and compliance with the public records chapter. But it also grants an added ability for the executive to withhold, quote, communications, memoranda, drafts, or other documents relating to developing policy positions, end quote. quoting them further, by writing the legislature and the governor into the public records law, we are affirming that the people of Massachusetts have a right to clearly see our work and how their tax dollars are spent. This builds on the success of this session's rules reforms, which were important steps in opening up our work to public view, while inviting more voices into the process, end quote. That was Ms. Spielke herself speaking Thursday. The branches also take different approaches to appeals in cases when someone's unhappy with the response to their record request. Under the bill advancing now in the Senate, an aggrieved requester could appeal the decision of the House or Senate's records access officer. First, the requester could ask for a reconsideration, which would require a written statement of the reasons for the denial be shared also with the branch's Rules Committee. The Rules Committee could reverse or modify the records access officer's decision. After that, a denied requester could appeal to the Superior Court. The House version would direct appeals to the Supreme Judicial Court. The bill expected to pass the Senate earned plaudits from the same advocates who praised the House version. Common Cause Massachusetts, Executive Director Jeff Foster, Massachusetts Newspaper Publishers Association Executive Director Robert Ambrogi, AMBROGI, NACLU of Massachusetts Director Carol Rose. Rose is quoted as saying, "We strongly support the Senate's thoughtful bill and appreciate the legislature taking necessary steps to improve transparency within a framework that is legally defensible. This historic expansion of our public records law builds on proposals that we and fellow advocates have long promoted, and we look forward to seeing it enacted into law," end quote. When the House passed its public records bill, the backers of question one on this fall's ballot said they had serious concerns about both its substance and the process by which it came before lawmakers. Danielle Allen, the 2022 gubernatorial candidate who is founder and convening chair of the so-called Coalition for Healthy Democracy, said that the group remains committed to supporting the ballot initiative for public records reform, which would apply the public records law to both the governor's office and the legislature, just as it applies to other public bodies across Massachusetts. She continued, "The people of Massachusetts should not have to rely on politicians to decide what records they are allowed to see. The ballot initiative establishes a simple principle. Government records should be public unless a specific exemption applies. This is the transparency and accountability Massachusetts voters deserve from their elected leaders," end quote. The records reform bills on the move in the legislature affirm that lawmakers have a much different view of reform than the initiative petition supporters, and the potential for competing and conflicting laws appears to be growing. The Senate Ways and Means Committee bill eyes an effective date of January 1, 2027, the same as the ballot question, but it would only apply to records made or received on or after January 6, 2027, the start of the next legislative term. It declares that records made or received before then, quote, should not be considered a legislative record, end quote. Mirroring the House bill, the bill the Senate will vote on next week would also appropriate $1 million for costs associated with maintaining records and responding to requests, $250,000 to each chamber, to the governor's office, and to joint legislative operation. Even if it is not added to the Senate bill, eventual negotiations on the records reform bill will also involve a House-approved measure that narrows the scope of a voter-approved legislative audit, limiting the auditor's power to investigate the branch to four categories of administrative functions, rather than the more expansive language which was outlined in the 2024 ballot law. This is Fran, continuing the July 24th, and I'm still on front page of the Sun from Saturday. And we have a legislative piece by the Media News Group itself, Allison Kuznets and Ella Adams as the writers, and Dateline Boston. It says the Democratic-controlled House passed legislation Wednesday that loosens restrictions on abortions that can be performed after 24 weeks of gestation, with supporters saying that the policy change will enable more residents with serious complications to remain in Massachusetts rather than needing to travel out of state to seek their care. The bill scraps the four types of exemptions currently outlined in statute for life-threatening situations for the mother or fetus, instead giving deference to doctors' professional judgment. The bill passed the House on a 119-33 vote, with all Republicans who voted casting their votes against the bill. Democrats who rejected the bill also included Representative Brian Ash, Lisa Field, Michael Finn, Dennis Gallagher, Russell Holmes, Christopher Markey, Francisco Paulino, Alan Sylvia, and Jeffrey Turtico. Representative Susanna Whips, the chamber's only independent member, voted yes. Judiciary Committee Chair Representative Michael Day said the law has evolved as Beacon Hill works to ensure women, quote, have the freedom to make their own reproductive decisions, end quote, and to respond to feedback from physicians who have been unable to provide abortion after 24 weeks. As he told, this again speaking of Mr. Day, to reporters, what we have done through the years, through three different iterations now, is try to get it right so that we can get out of the way and the medical profession can have a discussion with the expectant mother to seek the best care for that individual as possible. Public Health Committee Chair Representative Marjorie Decker said the legislation ensures medical decisions are rooted in medical judgment rather than legal risks. Quoting her, this bill does not tell a patient what decision to make. It does not force anyone to have an abortion. It does not take away decision-making from patients. It says that when a patient and their doctor are making a deeply personal and complex medical decision, the Commonwealth continues to trust them. End quote. The House has laid aside an amendment from Republican Representative Joseph McConnell of Sutton that would have allowed Bay Staters to indicate they don't want any of their tax liability used on abortion services. Assistant Majority Leader Alice Pesch, P-E-I-S-C-H, argued that the bill revolves around legal and medical standards for abortion procedures, while McKenna's policy focused on tax administration and the allocation of public funds. Branch leaders decided his amendments was beyond the scope of the legislation. Republican Representative Michael Soter, S-O-T-E-R, of Bellingham, spoke in opposition to a provision of the bill that he said would do away with the Department of Public Health reporting requirements for abortion services facilities to detail their procedures and processes. But bill co-sponsor, Representative Lindsay Zabadosa, S-A-B-A-D-O-S-A of Northampton, responded to Soter's comments on the floor to say that DPH reporting requirements are still in statute in another section of the bill, aside from the section that was being scrapped. Representative Kelly Pease, a Westfield, Republican, said he was blindsided by the legislation and called abortion a terrible thing. Quoting him, I think most of our caucus was, it's like, where did this come from? He said this to the news service on Wednesday morning. He said, I don't see how I'm going to be in favor of a bill that allows babies over 6 months to be terminated when they're probably viable outside the womb, unless there's extenuating circumstances. And this kind of just takes away some of the safeguards that were in place before, end quote. The legislation now heads to the Senate. House Speaker Ron Mariano said that he hasn't any conversations about this particular issue with the Senate. Moving off the front page into the local news page, at the top of the page we have a picture of cocaine seized recently on Perry Street in Lowell. This article by Aaron Curtis, curtis@lowellsun.com as his email address, acurtis@lowellsun.com. It says a man with a long criminal history was arrested after police say they uncovered more than a pound of cocaine inside his vehicle during a traffic stop ending in Perry Street driveway. The Lowell Police Department said the arrest unfolded in chaos after Alberto Marbert, M-A-R-B-E-R-T, 34 years of age, of Nashua, grabbed plastic bags containing cocaine and tried to escape the vehicle, triggering a struggle that caused one of the bags to break. The burst sent the cocaine powder billowing over two officers, Marbert, and across the driveway that he had pulled over into. According to the police incident report, the situation began around 7:40 p.m., July 14th, when two neighborhood response unit officers spotted a black Ford Escape headed inbound on Roger Street with no front license plate and window tint so dark that no light was able to transmit through. The vehicle pulled into a driveway in the 100 block of Perry Street, where officers recognized the driver as Marbert. According to the report, the officers were familiar with him through numerous previous interactions and know him to have a long criminal history of possessing firearms and distributing narcotics. The report goes on to state that Marbert was convicted in 2011 in Middlesex Superior Court for unlawful possession of a firearm, and he served an 18-month sentence. His passenger, a 28-year-old Lowell man, was also known to police and described as a suspected member of the so-called Young Gunners. This is a gang, investigators say, has been tied to numerous violent crimes, including 2020 in Lowell. Police say they first focused on the passenger after spotting a hammer at his feet, a potential safety risk. The man initially refused commands to exit the vehicle, but eventually complied and was patted down, at which point no weapons were found. Police say they then turned to Marbert, telling him he needed to exit so they could check the vehicle for additional weapons. The report states that Marbert went from positive to abrasive, refusing to get out, and stating that he did not consent to a vehicular search. One officer opened a rear door behind the passenger seat to check for weapons and allegedly spotted two zip-close bags filled with a white powdery substance believed to be cocaine. According to the report, Marbert grabbed the bags and tried to flee out the front passenger door. An officer grabbed him, and the two tumbled out of the vehicle. Police say Marbert attempted to toss the bags to his passenger. He is alleged to have then squeezed one of the bags, causing it to rupture, which sent the cocaine airborne, coating the officers, Marbert himself, and the driveway. During the alleged struggle, one officer delivered one punch to Marbert's face, according to the report, which lists Marbert as 5'8" and 200 pounds. After Marbert was taken into custody, Pride Star Trinity EMS evaluated him at the scene before he was transported to Lowell General Hospital, Saints Campus, for further evaluation. Police said that during the struggle, Marbert's passenger fled the scene. A so-called Be on the Lookout, or BOLO, alarm was issued for this 28-year-old man, whose involvement as a whole remained unclear, according to the report. A search of the vehicle uncovered additional bags containing a white powdery substance, and in total, officers allegedly found four bags weighing 615 grams, roughly 1.36 pounds, all which later tested positive for cocaine. On July 15th, Marbert was arraigned on the charges of trafficking in 200 grams or more of cocaine, withholding evidence from a criminal proceeding, resisting arrest, number plate violation, window obstructed, non-transparent, in the Lowell District Court before Judge Coffey. He was held pending a 58A dangerousness hearing that took place later that same day. As part of that hearing, the Middlesex District Attorney's Office submitted a lengthy overview of his past criminal history, describing him as a participant in a large-scale cocaine trafficking conspiracy investigated between 2017 and 2019. And according to this overview, Marbert known by the nickname Homeboy, was intercepted on wiretaps discussing trafficking weight quantities of cocaine, including half-ounce, ounce, and large amounts he allegedly obtained for resale. Middlesex Assistant District Attorney Graham Van Epps stated in the overview that the wiretaps also captured him seeking ammunition and negotiating the purchase of multiple firearms, including 9mm, 40 caliber, and 45 caliber pistols. In one intercepted call, investigators said that Marbert referenced having 25 grams left, quote, along with multiple additional quantities he had already sold. In another, he allegedly told a co-conspirator that he had, quote, two plays, end quote, lined up, one involving an ounce of cocaine and another involving 19 grams. Van Epps stated that Marbert's communication showed an ongoing pattern of trafficking activity, including discussions about confronting an individual, while armed, and conversations about acquiring an arsenal of firearms. Following the hearing, Marbert was ordered held on $250,000 cash bail or a $2.5 million surety. If he posts bail, court documents state he must follow conditions, including that he maintain or seek employment, have no contact with his co-defendant, possess no dangerous weapons, and obey all laws. Marbert is scheduled to return to court for a probable cause hearing August 11th. His attorney, Robert Scarano, S-C-A-R-A-N-O, was not available immediately for comment. Still on the local news page, we have a photo of what is the Edge 24-hour private fitness program, and they partnered with Pride Star Trinity EMS to install an automated external defibrillator outside the facility of the Draco Gym that was owned by Paul Newt, who died recently. And it shows people who were at that presentation. We have Pride Star Trinity EMS Senior Vice President of Corporate Strategies, John Kamali, Director of Education and Clinical Services, Dave Green, COO Brian Shanley, and Police Chief Tim Crowley, Paul Newt's father-in-law Joe Moses, his wife Kathy Newt, son Braddock, Draycott Police Lieutenant Dimitri Melonakis, Pride Star Trinity EMS Senior Vice President of Public Relations and Marketing, Christopher Dick, and President and CEO David Daly. There's a small photo of Mr. Newt. Paul Newt, and this is considered a submitted article. It says nearly 9 months after the tragic passing of Edge 24-hour private fitness owner Paul Newt, Pride Star Trinity MS joined his family, friends, and local public safety leaders to help ensure that his legacy continues to save lives. Following Paul Newt's sudden cardiac emergency at his Draco Gym in October 2025, gym members and first responders immediately began life-saving efforts before transporting him to the hospital. But despite everyone's effort, Paul later passed away peacefully after a courageous battle with heart disease. Determined to honor Paul's memory and protect others, Paul's wife, Katie, and members of the Edge Fitness community, including Atkinson, New Hampshire Police Chief and friend Tim Crowley, and Drake Police Lieutenant and Paul's close friend, Dimitri Melonakis, approached Pride Star Trinity MS, seeking assistance in placing an automated external defibrillator inside that facility. Working together, Pride Star, President and CEO David Daly, partnered with Katie Newt and friends to help equip Edge Fitness with a new Zoll, Z-O-L-L, AED Plus and protective wall-mounted AED cabinet. And in addition, Pride Star will provide complimentary CPR and AED training for Paul's wife, Katie, for family members, gym staff, and friends in the coming weeks. The AED is now permanently installed inside the Edge 24-hour private fitness club, where it will be immediately accessible during any future emergency, not just for gym members, but potentially anyone throughout the surrounding plaza. Daly said, Paul built more than a gym, he built a community. And while nothing can undo the tragedy that occurred here, We hope this AED serves as a lasting reminder of his impact and his commitment to helping others live healthier lives. While we all hope this AED never has to be used, knowing it's here and that members have been trained means this community is even better prepared if an emergency ever arises. And that's what giving back is all about. And if it helps save even one life, it will be a fitting tribute to Paul's legacy. Sudden cardiac arrest can strike anyone, anywhere, often without warning. Immediate CPR combined with rapid access to an AED dramatically increases a person's chance of survival. The installation of the AED and the upcoming training reinforce PrideStar Trinity EMS's ongoing commitment to strengthening community preparedness through education, prevention, and partnerships. As family and friends continue to remember Paul, the hope is that his story inspires others to learn CPR, make AEDs more readily available, and recognize the importance of being prepared when seconds matter. Still on that local page, or local news page, an article by Flint McColgan with the Herald. His email address, flintmcColgan@bostonherald.com. That's flint.mcColgan@bostonherald.com. It says the judge for the murder trial of Duxbury mother, Lindsay Clancy, has ordered that autopsy photos of the three children and the 911 call from Patrick Clancy will be for courtroom presentation only and not be published by the media. The Plymouth Superior Court Judge William Sullivan wrote, quote, for the reasons set forth in the father's request and the impounded supporting materials, the court finds that any such access, recording, display, reproduction, distribution, or other dissemination by the media will create a substantial likelihood of harm or other harmful consequences to the father and the family of Cora Clancy, Dawson Clancy, and Callan Clancy. He said that he quoted allowances in a Supreme Judicial Court rule on media access to materials. His order will apply with the same scope, force, and effect to any individuals or members of the public. The order is not intended to affect the trial in any way. Specifically, nothing in this order shall limit or restrict either the Commonwealth or the defendant from introducing, presenting, or utilizing the aforementioned items of evidence at the trial on this matter, says Sullivan. Members of the public present in the courtroom are permitted to listen to and observe the evidence as presented during the course of the trial. That is scheduled to begin Monday. Miss Lindsay Clancy, 36 years of age, or I should say Mrs., is charged with the murder of her three children, Cora, 5, Dawson, 3, Callan, 8 months. Prosecutors say that she sent her husband, Patrick Clancy, out to pick up dinner and children's medicine from a drugstore in Plymouth, and then strangled her three children with exercise bands in the basement of the family home. Patrick Clancy found his wife sprawled on the driveway after she had purportedly jumped from their bedroom window on the second floor and called 911. As first responders arrived to tend to Lindsay Clancy, Patrick Clancy discovered his children in the basement, according to previous court hearings and filings. Lindsay Clancy's attorney, Kevin Reddington, has repeatedly said he does not contest the events of January 24, 2023, and is instead mounting a psychiatric defense. He says that his client was suffering from postpartum psychosis and was on an unbalanced medley of medication that clouded her mind. Patrick Clancy's attorney, David Meyer, argued Thursday that the 911 call and any photographs and videos of the children, whether before or after their deaths, be limited to courtroom appearance and not be disseminated in the media. Neither Reddington or prosecutor Jennifer Sprague challenged that request. We also have on that local page the 5-minute read, usually just about Lowell, but many times of surrounding towns, highlighting things to do, places to go, people that are known in the greater Lowell area. It does ask also that if you've got news to share, please send it to news@lowellsun.com. and submissions must be received at least 1 week in advance to be considered for publication. And it said if you submit a photograph, it should be at least 300 kilobytes in a JPEG format. Now, these tend to be all Lowell. They can be something that happened or is about to happen. It says Lowell, the Lowell Plan, celebrated the 2026 Public Matters graduation at the annual graduation and networking night, June 24th. And there is a picture of the Lowell Plan Public Matters 2026 cohort. And it names them Lizzie Bo, that's B-O, John Heng, H-E-N-G, Elizabeth Rodriguez, Jenna Gilbo, G-U-I-L-B-E-A-U-L-T, Autumn Kleiner, Marcy DeCarli, D-E-C-A-R-L-I, Jordana Shaw, Alexa Carter, Jo Ellen Folger, Ken Michienzi, M-I-C-H-I-E-N-Z-I, Ainsley Moorhead, Deandra Slick, Dai Kim, Melissa Duncan, Nick Schonberger, S-C-H-O-N-B-E-R-G-E-R, Christine Speciale, S-B-E-C-I-A-L-E, Sophia Boucher, B-O-U-C-H-E-R, Brianna Martinez, Eric Diaz, and John Batzelder. The Public Matters is a six-month civic leadership program led by the Lowell Plan in partnership with Lowell National Historic Park. The program brings together emerging leaders from across Lowell to strengthen their knowledge of civic engagement, collaboration, and community leadership, helping build the skills needed to shape the city's future. Special thanks to partners at the Lowell National Historical Park, UMass Lowell, and the Public Matters team, Joseph Bond, that's B-A-N-H, Frank Clark, and Melissa Supernant. For more information, you can go online to lowellplan.org, lowellplan.org. Also from Lowell, the public is invited to hear from the 17th Middlesex District State Representative candidates and ask questions during the Lowell Downtown Neighborhood Association Candidate Forum. That'll be July 27th, Monday, 7 p.m. at the Hive Public Market. That's 101 Page Street. Hive Public Market, 101 Page Street, P-A-I-G-E. The president, Ken Michienzi, will moderate the forum between candidates Harini Ayer, A-I-Y-E-R, John Drinkwater, and Anthony Light, L-E-I-T-E. For more information, contact by email, contact@ldna01852.org. contact@ldna01852.org. Also from Lowell. This will be next Tuesday coming up. Enjoy a free showing of the movie Lilo and Stitch, 2 to 4 p.m. in the ground floor meeting room of the Pollard Library on July 28th, which is Tuesday, 2 to 4 p.m., and that's at 401 Merrimack Street. The craft will be a 3D surf shop foam kit. I'm not quite sure what that means exactly, but the Tuesday, August 11th movie is called Up, and the craft is a memory box. Registration is required, and space is limited, but you can go online to, again, one of these complicated links, bit.ly/3Kv8HT. Again, bit.ly/3Kv8HT. Or you can go to 978-674-1529, 978-674-1529 for information, or online to lowelllibrary.org, lowelllibrary.org. Also from Lowell. In addition to the flags customarily flown at the JFK Plaza, the city commemorates flags from many countries and other locations all during the year. And on Saturday, August 8th at 1 p.m., the public is invited to a flag raising for Puerto Rico. The outdoor event is held in front of City Hall at 375 Merrimack Street. Upcoming dates include India, Saturday, August 15th at 10:30 a.m., Liberia, Saturday, August 22nd at 11 a.m. El Salvador, Saturday, August 29th at noon. In Nigeria, Saturday, October 3rd at noon. To schedule a flag-raising ceremony at City Hall, please submit an application to the Office of Cultural Affairs and Special Events 3 to 4 weeks prior to the date of the flag-raising. And, unfortunately, another one of these online links, bit.ly/3, capital letters SX, small letters CYB, capital letter B. Again, bit.ly/3, capital letters SX, small letters CYB, capital letter B. Applications will be reviewed on a first-come, first-served basis. You can also call 978-674-1482. That's the city, 978-674-1482. Or email rdei@lowellmass.gov. rdei@lowellma.gov. Or you can go online at lowellma.gov/1410/flag-raising. lowellma.gov/1410/flag-raising. And also one last one about Lowell. People in need of food assistance are invited to apply to Dwelling House of Hope at, again online, dwellinghouseofhope.org. Federal regulations require them to obtain a self-declaration of income report to document assistance which is being provided to low and moderate income households. So for more information, call 866-674-9988, 866-674-9988, or email to info@dwellinghouseofhope.org. info@dwellinghouseofhope.org. And two other articles of note in the Saturday paper. One from the Associated Press, a writer called Didi Tang, D-I-D-I-T-A-N-G, 8 Line, Washington. It says, Ezra Jin, J-I-N, Mingri, M-I-N-G-R-I, was inside a detention center in southern China on the morning of July 3rd, worrying that he would likely spend at least 15 years behind bars. This 57-year-old Chinese Christian pastor had even previously wondered whether he would live to see freedom again. In the span of 24 hours, Mr. Jin was 15 time zones away, digging into an In-N-Out hamburger in Los Angeles and watching fireworks, which is with his family, on the eve of July 4th, marking America's 250th anniversary. The pastor said to the Associated Press outside the Capitol, "It's so dramatic, it's unimaginable." He said he was suddenly released after being held since October and then put on a plane to the United States after President Trump raised his case with Chinese leader Xi Jinping in May. Jin Mingri said, "It's a miracle." He had led one of China's most influential underground churches, which defy government restrictions by not being registered with authorities. He is an exceptional case of a high-profile Chinese detainee going free following a U.S. request at a time when Beijing's leadership has only become more unyielding to foreign pressure. The Chinese pastor credits the president for his release. He said Chinese authorities released him without forcing him to make a confession or going through a show trial, dropping the charges instead. He said he did not know if there was any deal or swap for his release, and he credited President Trump's unique diplomacy. He said, quote, "It has results," end quote. The president, when leaving Beijing in May, told reporters that he brought up Mr. Mingri's case and that Xi said he would, quote, "strongly consider," the pastor, end quote. The president also vowed to, quote, "save our great Christian population worldwide." When asked about Ezra Jim Mingri's release, the Chinese foreign ministry said the country manages religious affairs in accordance with the law. And they said, quote, "We firmly oppose interference in China's internal affairs with so-called religious issues," end quote. However, Jin Mingri said he was called suddenly to gather his few belongings, including a Bible, back on July 3rd. He was handed new clothes and a pair of Nike shoes. He was told he was being moved from the detention center in the southern city of Beihai, B-E-I-H-A-I, where he had been locked up for 266 days. He said to himself, could it be that these people now pressured would put me under home arrest? But he had heard about his lawyers, from his lawyers, that President Trump had brought up his case with the Chinese president less than 2 months earlier. But he crossed that possibility out when police van whisked by his old neighborhood and took right by his house to a high-speed train station. He was escorted into a train car with no other passengers, just police officers who were recording video. He said he still did not imagine that he could be freed because China rarely responds to outside pressure, and many other Christian pastors and political activists are still locked up there.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.